Good afternoon. The time is 2 o'clock. Welcome to the Vox Pod for this Monday, January 23rd. Pardon me. I'm Alan Shartok. Support for Medical Monday comes from Stavros, helping people with disabilities achieve their dreams. Offices in Amherst, Greenfield, and Springfield. Stavros.org for more information. Joining this afternoon for Medical Monday are doctors Thamaj Small and Anika Chady of Southwestern Vermont Medical Center. They're here to answer your questions about obstetrics and gynecology. We always get a lot of calls on this program, so get yours in now. The number is 1-800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. Dr. Small and Chady, your calls and more, all coming up on the Vox Pop right after this news.
Support comes from Union Gables Mansion Inn, Saratoga Springs, providing hotel amenities in a historic bed and breakfast setting with a heated pool, wraparound porches, and private balconies. UnionGables.com. Pelham Auto Service at the Amherst-Belchertown line, located by the sign of the Flying Pig, a worker-owned and operated service repairing foreign cars since 1972. PelhamAuto.com. And from Ichiban Japanese and Chinese Restaurant, Central Avenue, Albany. Serving hibachi dinners, sushi, sashimi, curry soups, and Thai entrees. Daily specials, delivery expanding to Gilderland, 518-432-0358.
Hello, once again, and welcome back to the Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Alan Shartok. Joining us on this Medical Monday to discuss obstetrics and gynecology are doctors Thamaj Small and Anika Chady of Southwestern Vermont Medical Center. Dr. Small received her medical degree from the University of California, Los Angeles, Geffen School of Medicine. She's a fellow of the American College of Obstetrics and Gynecology. Dr. Chady received her medical degree from St. George's University School of Medicine in Granada. She completed an obstetrics and gynecology residency at Lincoln Medical and Mental Health Center in New York City. Dr. Small and Chady, welcome to the Medical Monday. The number, everybody, you know the number, 1-800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. You guys excited to be here?
Excited.
Oh, we sure are. Thank you for having us, Alan.
Well, we're delighted to have you. This is a very important area. Let me just start by saying, right now, there's a question as to whether young women should be getting the HPV vaccination. Should they?
I believe that women should be getting this vaccine. It's like one of the extremely important vaccines that we do recommend. It does prevent cervical cancer, vulvar cancer, vaginal cancer, even anal cancer. So I definitely would recommend it, not only to women, but also to boys as well, between the ages of 9 to 26.
Are we already seeing some results from, this has been around for a couple of years now, right? So should we should be seeing some
yes,
results.
We are indeed. The prevalence of cervical cancer has been declining over the last couple of years.
Already.
Already.
That's just amazing. That's just amazing. All of a sudden, women's body parts are being prominently talked about on marches and everywhere else. Does that represent a change in the way, you know, I mean, did people really want to use the words like vulva and vagina before? I think people thought they were, you know, no-no words. And all of a sudden, women are proud and they're talking about
it. Well, and I think they ought to be. I think that for a long time we chose not to talk about these body parts, and unfortunately it led to a lot of misconceptions about how women should be taking care of themselves. And I have had women, even as recently as the last 5 years, tell me they're not quite sure what a vulva is and ask me to tell them what that was. And I thought it was a step of courage for folks to be able to even ask the question. But now, of course, it's a word that's been loudly talked about on the public stage. I think that women are going to feel more and more comfortable, hopefully using this in terms of ways to keep themselves most healthy.
And so now we see, should I ask you a political question? Probably not. But now we see, you know, a sort of a Trumpian war against abortion and for so many of the women's organizations that take care of people. Is this frightening to you guys?
You know, I think that there are a lot of unknowns in the next few months and years, and we're all very proud of the advances that have been made in women's health and in medicine as a whole, and we hope to hold on to those. We'll have to see how it goes over the next little bit.
So you guys ready to take some calls?
Sure.
Yes.
And then I won't ask you any more bad questions. Okay. We'll go to Jim in Pennsylvania. Jim, go ahead. Go ahead, Jim.
Where is the incision for a C-section usually made, through the linea alba vertically or horizontally through the muscle?
So could you say the first part of that question over one more time?
What is the incision that is made? Is it, go ahead, Jim, is it what?
Vertically through the linea alba or horizontally through the muscle?
Nowadays, the most common type of cesarean section, we usually do it horizontally, right by the bikini line. We do recommend this form of incision. It heals better. It's a better form of incision that we do recommend.
I should say that it doesn't actually go through the muscle. Interestingly, there's a misconception that it is that we do transect those muscles, but actually they are pushed gently to the side, and that does improve healing for women, we found. There are certain circumstances where it is a good idea to do a vertical incision, but again, most of the time these are done horizontally now.
Well, as we're talking about it, it does it is interesting that for a long time there was this sort of myth that if you had the first one, cesarean, C-section, then the second one had to be also. Then I've been reading lately that that's not so much anymore.
Absolutely. So as medicine has evolved and we've gotten more experience, what we have found that actually it is safer to have a vaginal birth after a cesarean section in many circumstances.
Than a cesarean? Safer than a cesarean?
Do you know, in certain respects, it actually is. It depends very much on the situation with the patient and her medical situation, as well as with the position and the well-being of the baby.
Do we have too many C-sections?
I think that we all are concerned about the rate of cesarean sections, and it has been decreasing more recently. There's been a large focus on decreasing the cesarean section rate, and it hasn't necessarily decreased as quickly as I think many of us had hoped over the last 10 to 20 years, but we're very encouraged by the drop in rate, and our hopes now are not to get to a zero rate of cesarean section or repeat cesarean section, but to get to the right number of cesarean sections.
Dr. JD, when people come to you and talk to you about whether to have a section or not, how do you handle that?
Well, with all my patients, it's important to, know their history, whether they've had one or more cesarean sections. You know, there are certain criteria that we do follow to find out whether a patient would be a good candidate for a trial of labor after cesarean section, which we call TOLAC. I do counsel them about, the pros and cons of having a repeat cesarean section versus having a trial of labor after cesarean section.
Okay. Thank you very much, Jim. Appreciate starting us off that way. 1-800-348-2551. 1-800-348-2551. We'll go to Ellen. All right. Ellen, it's your turn. Go ahead.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm calling actually on behalf of my mother, who is 92. And for at least a year and a half, she has had issues with UTIs, urinary tract infections. Or so it's been diagnosed as that. And she's been on so many different antibiotics. They've got her on an estrogen cream now. Everything is causing her to burn. She is up many times through the night with an overactive bladder. And I understand that elderly people, women especially, do have issues as they age. But is this what the end of her life has to look like? I mean, she's always been healthy.
Oh, good question, Ellen. Thank you for calling in. This has been a very common common topic for many women, especially in the elderly age. And as you know, you go through menopause, you know, you do have a decrease in the estrogen level, and that can cause you to have many urinary tract infections and vaginal dryness in the area. I would definitely recommend speaking to your provider. You know, there are many different causes for urinary tract infections, and there are new advances in medicine right now with the use of the estrogen cream, which will help.
So we think estrogen is the cause for these infections?
One of the major causes.
Lack of it, right?
Lack of estrogen, right. Yes.
But also the problem with estrogen has always been, right, that people who take the estrogen in order to avoid the hot flashes and all the rest. Now, out of my depth here.
For vaginal dryness, we do recommend using vaginal estrogen. Right. So it's only in that area in the form of either a patch, a pill, a cream, which studies have shown it really doesn't cause an increase in uterine cancer, for instance.
Dr. Small, you want to answer that?
Right. So
she's on a cream. She's been on a cream for a while, and it's not helping the burning at all.
So it could very well be that she has superimposed conditions of the vulva, and certainly.
I can't hear you.
Yes.
I said it certainly could be that she has superimposed conditions of the vulva. So, for instance, just because you've got vaginal atrophy doesn't mean that you don't also have other skin sensitivities. And it could very well be that she requires the use of a barrier ointment in between applications of the estrogen cream. Another possibility.
What's a barrier ointment? I'm sorry.
Something as simple as Vaseline or coconut oil.
Uh-huh.
A lot of ladies can get some relief by keeping irritating fluids such as urine or irritation such as friction away from very sensitive vulvar skin. Additionally, some people will benefit from the application of topical lidocaine. That is a double-edged sword. It can also burn, but for some folks, they can get some relief with that. Additionally, I would say it sounds like you are doing a great job in advocating for your mom, but it would be a good idea for someone to take a look directly at that area and see whether or not there are breaks in the skin which would benefit from other healing medications.
Has that been done, Ellen?
It has been. It's all been done.
Yeah. Okay. Well, Ellen, good luck to you and good luck to your mom.
Thank you very much.
Appreciate it. Yeah, bye. Okay, 1-800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. We'll go to Deborah in Hudson. All right, Deborah in Hudson, you're on.
Hello there. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
My question is around the HPV vaccination. I'm just wondering if the advisors that you have are also willing, when they advise people about that, to talk about the side effects that have been found from HPV and the number of lawsuits that have been filed internationally around side effects that young women have experienced after receiving the vaccination.
Okay, there's your question, ladies. Who wants to go first? Yeah.
Okay, so that's a tough one. Your medication is strong medicine, just to say the obvious. And so people can have reactions to medication. What we have found is that on balance, the benefit to individuals and society is considerably greater than the risk that almost all individuals have. Some of the side effects that were originally reported included things like fainting, for instance. And what we discovered is actually the people who get the vaccines are usually early adolescent females and males, and they actually are more likely to faint with any kind of an injection than other folks might be. And so it is no longer thought to be a medication-specific side effect. You know, certainly you never want to see a side effect that's unpleasant or unexpected or even dangerous in any of your patients.
And so one of them is fainting? Is that what you said?
Right. So that was one of the ones that was early reported, but has now no longer been associated specifically with the HPV vaccine.
Right. Well, Deborah, thank you for your call. We have to take a break.
Excuse me. Could I just ask one more question? I was actually very concerned for my daughter involving that, and I did a lot of research on it and found that it wasn't just fainting, but a number of deaths, and that the woman who actually was involved in developing the HPV vaccination for Merck in Germany has come out to warn parents against it. Do you let people know that?
You know, I certainly think that all parents need to be well-informed, and there's certainly access to this sort of data, you know, easily on our smartphones at this point. So I think that one would be surprised at how many of these conversations we have, which we're always very happy to have.
Okay, thank you. We have to take a break. All right, and appreciate the ladies. We'll be right back, and we'll talk to Laura, who is in Albany.
Support comes from Real Seafood Company, Wolf Road, Conlanee, locally owned seafood restaurant and raw bar, realseafoodco.com. Gazebo, Northampton, Massachusetts, an independent lingerie shop specializing in bra and post-mastectomy fittings, providing support to the Pioneer Valley for almost 40 years, the-gazebo.com. And from Noble Home, Shelburne Falls, Massachusetts, offering prefabricated house kits using local materials and featuring passive solar and net zero energy designs. More information at noble-home.net. Nathan LaTower Hospital, Gloversville, New York, announcing new primary care center on Main Street in Fonda, opening in 2017, nlh.org. And from Careers in Transition LLC, Albany, Dr. Tom Denham, providing individual career guidance, testing, job strategies, interview preparation, LinkedIn lessons, resume, and cover letter writing. Careers in Transition LLC.com.
Thank you, Zachary. We are back, and we'll take a call from Laura in Albany. All right, Laura, you're on with the doctors. Go ahead.
Yes, I have a comment and a question. I want to agree with the woman who just called about the vaccine that you're talking about. I would highly urge any moms and daughters to research this vaccine. There have been terrible side effects. And the Center for Media and Democracy did a study about this vaccine when it first came out, and it was shown that there was a whole lot of money being put into PRing this, into having women believe that their daughters needed it, and in fact, families believe that their sons needed it also.
Okay, so Laura, that's your commentary, your comment. What's your question?
Yes, my question is, we know that there are supposed to be good bacteria in our guts, in the biome. We also know that there's research being done into the good bacteria that should be in our sinuses. Could you talk about research in the good bacteria that women can insert into their vaginas to keep keep it healthy?
Well, you know, I tend to trust women's bodies in general. They tend to work really nicely, except very, very rare situations when they don't. And the area inside of the vagina tends to be an area which is full of all sorts of healthful bacteria, as well as probably viruses and also funguses. And so we would say is you want to avoid things that are going to disrupt that balance, which could be anything ranging from cosmetics that go inside of the vagina or on the outside of the vagina, certain lubricants, as well as antibiotics or douching products.
So what are some of the no-nos? I mean, what is it that women should really avoid in terms of the treatment of that area?
I do agree with Dr. Small. I believe douching, sometimes even just wearing tight clothes, for instance, spandex. It's really important to wear cotton underwear. With the use of a lot of antibiotics as well, can also disrupt the flora as well and cause things like yeast infections as well.
Yeah. Okay. Caller, anything more?
I would be interested if you could tell me where I can go research this, because it's really cutting edge. And I don't know where to go. So any thoughts as to where to research probiotics, good bacteria for the vagina?
So if you look on PubMed, there's a lot of research on probiotics. And
is that PubMed?
PubMed.
Yeah.
Right. And so probiotics are used routinely for folks who are undergoing particularly prolonged but even short courses of antibiotic in order to maintain the good flora in the digestive system and the vaginal tract.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. 1-800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. I guarantee you, if you call now, you'll get on. 1-800-348-2551. Doctors Thimar Small and Anika Shady of Southwestern Vermont Medical Center are here with us today, and now's your chance to get your questions answered. So tell me, doctors, why should men be concerned with the work you do?
Why should men be concerned about what?
In other words, is this purely work that that women should be concerned with, or is there any time at any point where men should be concerned with why an Abgayan person, what they have to say?
Well, so we think of OBGYN as part of population health.
Right.
So half the population is female. So we expect that half the population needs to be well, including in the reproductive area.
Right.
You know, certainly women make up an important part of the workforce and an important part of family life. And we need to keep everybody functioning in order for the whole society to be rolling forward.
When women come to see you, like to have their husbands with them?
Oh, that's a personal choice. It's a good question, but it's a personal choice. We never mind having a husband or a partner or a sister or a close friend or a daughter come on in the rooms for the discussions, and even the examinations can be comforting for patients to have someone familiar there with them.
Do you think that's changing for the better? Do you think more men are getting involved than in the old days?
I think so. I mean, even in our practice right now, I do feel like I see a lot of partners that come into the office, and I do try to engage with them if they do have any questions, for instance, with their pregnancy, for instance. I think it is increasing.
Also, I think increasingly we see partners involved in the actual birth process, and even more than the birth process, which has always been a rite of passage, with the actual whole health of the pregnancy all the steps away. And we all know that that the involvement of people who are close to you can help us to make the good changes that we need to in order to keep the pregnancy healthy.
Great. Okay, thank you for that. Let's go to, we'll go to Peter in Brunswick. Okay, Peter, you're on.
Hi, thank you so much for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm curious to know what the doctors would say to someone who has had exposure to herpes simplex virus type 1, you know, to what extent that should be a concern, to what extent that should be talked about, and any reaction they may have to someone who has had that in their past.
Now herpes 1 is what is for the lip and the face, or is that, what's, can you give us a definition of herpes 1 and herpes 2?
Herpes simplex 1, as many would know, it would usually cause ulcers, usually in the mouth area, for
sure.
instance. But recently we have been finding that herpes 1 can also cause genital herpes as well.
Oh, okay. And so the question is, somebody who has had a diagnosis of herpes, either one or other herpes, in life, should they refrain from intercourse for the rest of their life?
No, they should not refrain from intercourse with the rest of their life. I think it is important, if it is genital herpes, for instance, I think
sure.
it's important to have that conversation with your partner. There are several things that can be done. It is, you know, some people would like to be on, for instance, preventative measures, being on medications daily, or they would just like to be treated when they do have an
outbreak.
Are
there effective medications?
Oh, yes. Very, very effective medications.
So if somebody's in a sexual relationship, they could well be ingesting this medicine?
Yes, they can be. It's very safe. We even recommend it in pregnancy as well.
One thing I would like to say to the caller and anybody else who is listening is that herpes is considerably more common than you might think. So
like
for
somebody once told me 100%.
Potentially.
Or sexually active people, yeah.
Yep. Well, so herpes type 1, which is the one we normally think of as the cold sore virus,
yeah.
that could be up to 80 or 85% of people. And for the genital herpes, if you were to test exposure, not necessarily people who have outbreaks, but exposure, then you'd find that between 20 and 50% of the population has probably been exposed. That doesn't mean that everybody is going to have symptoms, and not everybody will transmit to their partners either. So what I would like to see is a more active conversation with folks. And I suggest you bring this up with your physicians as well, and talk to your providers to see whether or not this is the sort of how you should phrase the conversation that you're going to have with your new sexual partner about this risk.
So for those people who have multiple partners, would you give a different answer than you've given in terms of a conversation with your partner?
Do you know, really the same conversation needs to be had with all partners, and ideally each of the partners should know that they're not monogamous. That will help people to make better choices.
I have often said, Doc, there's a difference between should and is. You know, so the question is, should there be a public information campaign of some kind?
I am all for a public information campaign about herpes and about any other rash or.
And let's remember that we're talking about the potential for, cervical cancer here. So this is an important conversation.
Right. So cervical cancer is mostly associated with the HPV virus, which is very similar to HSV virus.
I'm sorry, yes.
And so, but true, they're transmitted in the same way. And so this is a conversation that we should feel comfortable being open with our medical providers as well as our partners in talking about these things.
Dr. Chady, do you want to add something to that?
I agree as well. I think it's a conversation that you need to have with your partner. And also, if you have any questions, please bring it up to your provider as well.
Peter, did you want to ask a follow-up or not?
No, I think that's sufficient. Thank you.
Thank you, Peter. Okay. 1-800-348-2551. 1-800-348-2551. We'll go to Ariel in Massachusetts. Okay, Ariel, you're on.
Hi, I hope you can hear me through this cell phone.
We can.
Great. This is related to yeast infection question, but from a slightly different angle. Because I have a bunch of organ prolapses that have really been slowing down my ability to empty my bladder for years, I was given a pessary by a urogynecologist, but unfortunately, after just 8 to 10 hours in my body, it really caused massive yeast.
Are you off? Okay, well, you cut out. I don't know why you cut out, but you cut out. Are you there still, Ariel?
No, this is Brenda.
Oh, how did we go from Ariel to Brenda? Well, something happened. Okay, Brenda, you ask your question. I don't know what line Brenda's on, but in any case, you ask your question, and then we'll try to answer both of them. Go ahead, Brenda.
I'm wondering about ocular herpes. It's a simplex one.
So what is your question about ocular herpes?
How is that related to, basically, the simplex one, simplex two? You said that simplex one also, you're finding that it also is affected in the vaginal outbreaks as well.
Right. So although herpes type 1 has a preference for the oral mucosa, it can certainly find its way to other areas as well. And an eye infection with herpes 1 can be devastating. So if folks do have that, they need to have regular care with their ophthalmologist.
And when you say devastating, is there something something very specific?
It can be very painful, obviously, but it can lead to blindness even.
Uh-huh. Come back on that, caller.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, thanks a lot. Okay, and we wanted to talk about yeast infections. Tell me what yeast is.
Right. So yeast is just a common name for candida, and we all have candida all over our bodies. including in the vagina, and it's considered a normal part of the vaginal flora. The thing is that there's also bacteria and there's potentially viruses in the vaginal flora as well. And sometimes a pH change or change in the using antibiotics can shift that flora enough that there will be overgrowth of either the bacteria or the yeast. The candidal infections can lead to all sorts of symptoms, which many women are familiar with, and luckily some women don't ever experience, but it tends to be itching and burning and discharge. And this is the sort of thing which can be recurrent for some ladies.
We hear about this with women The yeast infections with men too?
Well, there sure are. So athlete's foot, that's a yeast infection.
No kidding.
Yes.
I didn't know that.
Yep, any kind of
chalk itch. You learn something
every day. That's a yeast infection as well. They tend to be different strains, but essentially that's what it is. And so we just need to rebalance the natural system.
Okay. Thank you very much for that. Okay. Let's see here. We'll go to, I'm trying to look at who's been hanging on the longest, and that's line number four, and it is Liz in Albany. Okay, Liz, your turn.
Hi there. Thanks for taking my call. I have two school-age kids, and my son has started the HPV vaccine sequence, which is doctor-recommended. I'm very happy about it. But my question is regarding my daughter, and specifically I'm wondering when girls should start going to a gynecologist.
Oh, excellent question. I do think we do recommend that young girls should start going to their gynecologist between the ages of 13 and to 15. I think it's really important that young girls, I really wish that they would not be afraid to come to a gynecologist. I think a lot of girls feel as though if they do come for an examination, if they do come for a visit, they have to have a pelvic examination. And that is one thing that I would like to let the young population know, that they can come in just to talk about their normal menstrual cycle, for instance, to talk about preventative measures such as vaccines, birth control, emergency contraception. So I really do feel strongly about this.
But nevertheless, don't you want to do an examination? Wouldn't that be better?
We don't need to do an examination. If they are having a problem or a complaint, for instance, then we can do an examination. We do start pap smears at the age of 21, and that's when we can do a pelvic examination.
Dr. Small?
Well, and I should say that in our area, we're very fortunate that we have pediatricians who are comfortable with teen issues and teen gynecology care as well. And so if your daughter has a great relationship with her pediatrician and you feel that she can talk comfortably about such things as menstrual cycle abnormalities and potentially, questions about sexual activity or her friend's sexual activity, then perhaps it would be a great thing to see that pediatrician as well. But the gynecologists are always very happy to see kids as early as puberty and menstruation.
Thank you very much for the call. Okay, what we're going to do now is we're going to take a short break, and we'll be right back.
Support comes from Vermont Coffee Company, offering slow-roasted organic coffee in the brown paper bag at local grocery stores. Vermont Coffee Company, coffee roasted for friends. Saratoga Hospital Bariatric Surgery and Weight Loss Program, with Medical Director Dmitry Baranov and his team of healthcare professionals providing personalized weight loss options. SaratogaHospital.org for details. Penny Farthing Investment Management, Amherst, a socially conscious, fee-only investment advisor of personal retirement and endowment portfolios, including the Bright Penny Community Strategies, brightpenny.org. The Opalka Gallery at Sage College of Albany, featuring art exhibits and other cultural events, now hosting sculptor Caroline Rimmersdorfer, sage.edu/opalka. And from College Street Motors, Amherst, Massachusetts. For over 30 years, specializing in foreign and domestic car and truck repair and 24-hour towing. Full-service gas includes checking of fluids, tire pressure, and window washing. CollegeStreetMotors.com.
Thank you, Zach. Glad we're back. Okay, so hanging on now for 5 minutes and 2 seconds is Barbara from Boston Spa. All right, Barbara, you're on.
Ooh. Am I still on?
You very much are. Go ahead.
Oh, okay. Thank you. I'm calling about this Prevar 13, the pneumonia shot. I can't seem to find out. I talked to a pharmacist who said that you need two shots. I had one shot a year ago. I can find nothing on the internet. Just the advertisements and so forth. So what I want to know is, do you need two shots, or is one shot forever, or what?
Barbara, I'm going to be honest with you. Our docs, you've stumped the band. This is not really their area. And we appreciate your call very much, but we're going to move on because it is not something we know about. Thanks again. Okay. Now we'll go to we're going to go to for 5 minutes and 17 seconds, Jessica in Kingston. All right, Jessica, you're on.
Hi, Jessica.
Hi. Hello.
Hey. Go ahead.
I had a question. I had a child 9 months ago, and she was born 4 weeks and 2 days early. So I was just wondering, what are the chances if I have a second child? Am I more likely to have a premature birth again, or is there anything that can be done to prevent and maybe have the child go to full term?
Who wants to take this one, Dr. Small or Dr. Shady?
I will take it. Jessica, thank you for calling in. Excellent question. We do have a lot of patients who has this problem as well. With preterm labor, you do have a higher incidence of a chance of having preterm labor with your second child, more than the general population. But there are several things that we can do during your second pregnancy to screen for your risk of preterm labor. And there's several things that we can do. And I definitely would recommend that you speak with your provider. We do things like screen for your cervical length, for instance, and their progesterone administration as well with your second pregnancy.
Okay,
thank you very much.
Thank you, Jessica. Yeah,
thanks, bye. Jessica.
Thanks.
Hey, guys, what's an APGAR score?
Right, so the APGAR score, that is a numerical analysis of baby movement and breathing that happens immediately following birth, usually at time 1, 5, 7, and 10 minutes. And we use it to determine not so much well-being, but actually any signs of potential neurological deficit which would require resuscitation for the baby.
And can it come as a result of having ingested meconium or something like that?
There is a universe of things that can cause the baby's neurological well-being to be depressed. And ideally, we're aware of those things ahead of time and have a team on hand to help respond to it.
I know a Harvard graduate who had an APGAR score of 1.
Is that so?
Yeah, so they don't always work out.
Right, so exactly. It doesn't tell us about future well-being at all. It tells us about the likelihood.
At that moment.
Right, and for a need for resuscitation. So.
Okay, we got a lot of people on the phone here.
Great.
Okay, so let's go to, Mary Ann in Albany. Mary Ann in Albany on line number 2. Okay, Mary Ann, you're on.
Hi. I'm calling about infections, and one, you mentioned the UTI infection and how that sometimes is accompanied by like itching or burning, and the discharge. Now, if you have a discharge and there's no itching or burning, what other kind of infection? Also, I mean, this gets into the kind of details. Maybe people don't want to hear, but
that's why we're here.
Certain kinds of discharge, you know. So, what other infections might there be? You know, if there's no itching or burning accompanying it.
Dr. Shady.
Marianne, thank you for calling in. Excellent question. Discharge, a lot of people have a lot of questions about discharge. There's a wide range of differentials for vaginal discharge. It can be bacterial. It can be yeast infection, for instance. There's many other causes, and I definitely think that you should visit your provider because I do think that an exam will tell us more of the cause of your discharge.
Should we?
And that would be whether it's urinary tract or vaginal, right? I mean, that the same provider would know.
Yes.
The whole area.
The same provider would know. Yes.
Yeah.
And there's certain cultures.
Now the other
that
question. Thank you very much for that info.
Sure.
And the other question is this: with a UTI infection, my mother, who's dead now, but she would get the UTIs, and then at the same time she would have kind of like a confusion. Is there some kind of connection between UTIs and brain confusion?
Yes, there is. Sometimes urinary tract infections can cause what we call delirium, where there's this brief confusion, for instance. So the urinary tract infection has to be treated, and that brief confusion will usually go away. It's one of the causes.
What exactly is happening? That, I mean, your UTI, you know, that's in one area, and your brain is in another area, you know, further away. What's happening in between there that makes that connection?
Isn't that confusing? You know, it's funny. The mind and the body and the are all connected. And one of the ways that some of my patients and some of my patients' family members know that a urinary tract infection is in place is because of altered mental status. And it could be confusion or loss of memory, or it could be being sleepy all the time. We do worry about the infection traveling to the kidneys, and there is something called urosepsis. Urosepsis can also lead to changes in blood pressure, and it can be very dangerous for family members, particularly in the elderly. And so it's the phenomenon that you noticed is not an uncommon phenomenon, and it's one that we're always glad that family members see.
Marianne, I'm going to let you go. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay, let's go to Lainey in Lee. Lainey in Lee, that makes sense. It's alliteration if you took an English course. Okay.
Question about...
Yeah, go ahead.
Incontinence and Botox for alternate solution to incontinence, and what's your experience with that? And then I have another question about fibroids. Hello?
Sure, absolutely. Well, thanks for the question. I'm glad that you brought this up. So it sounds to me like you're talking about urgency incontinence or overactive bladder, and there are a number of medical therapies that are available for this, once behavioral therapies have been shown to not work very well. And so what the Botox injections can do is they actually decrease the contractility of the bladder muscle, and in doing so, they just decrease the incidence of urine loss from the bladder during these episodes. They can be very helpful for some people. Usually, we've tried a raft of other things first before folks are referred on to a urogynecologist for those things. I would certainly speak with your provider about it.
Okay. All right. Thank you. Now, can I ask a question about fibroids and fibroid surgery with the radiation and the drawbacks for that?
So the question is about fibroids. Could you say it again, please?
The fibroid surgery with radiation and the drawbacks for that? Removing your fibroid with the radiation, with the radiologist?
Dr. Shady?
Yes. There is a type of procedure. It's called uterine artery embolization, which is done with the radiologist. We pretty much try to cut the blood supply off to the fibroid, which will cause the fibroids to shrink.
Okay. What are the drawbacks to that? Would that affect pregnancy in the future, or...
Yes. We do recommend this form of treatment for someone who has completed their childbearing because, you know, we don't recommend any patient to get pregnant after this procedure.
Okay, thank you.
You're welcome.
Bye. Okay, now bye. I'm looking, oh boy, Lisa in Rensselaer has been waiting for 9 minutes. That's a long time. Okay, Lisa, you're on. Go ahead.
Hi, thank you very much for taking my call.
Sure.
I had a baby in December, and I have two questions. The first one's mostly out of curiosity. When I delivered my son, I had a cervical lip, and I was kind of wondering, is there something specific that kind of causes that? Because we managed to work through it, but I'm more so curious about why I might have had this issue where when it was time to push, my cervix wasn't fully dilated and his head was kind of caught behind it, if there's a reason that happens.
So, Lisa, congratulations. How's it going so far?
Oh, wonderful. He's my second, so I'm...
Oh, that's great.
Like old hat now.
Thank you. Good. Hey, you know, so medical terminology is so funny because it can be very misleading. So all that an anterior cervical lip is usually what we call it. And when we're speaking to each other as medical professionals in the room, we're trying to communicate that the cervix has not completely dilated. So some of us would call that like 9.5 centimeters or complete minus a little bit, but we usually call it an anterior lip. And that can have that can happen. It happens frequently, first of all. And it can happen depending on how quickly the dilation happened or the position of the baby's head. It's not an anatomical variation or anything to be worried about. And in a next pregnancy, there may or may not be any issues with an anterior cervical lip.
Okay, perfect. I wasn't concerned about it happening again. I was mostly just curious about it. The other thing I wanted to know, just specifically for you, what you recommend for your patients is birth control when they're breastfeeding. I had a Mirena previously, and it worked well for me, but I felt better when I had it out and was ready to conceive again. So I'm looking for something long-term. I just want to know what you recommended for your patients.
Well, sure. There's a whole variety of contraceptive options available, but you're right. When you're breastfeeding, you can't use anything that has estrogen. So that leaves you limited to progesterone-only methods or barrier methods such as condoms or female condoms. Or there are some folks who will do natural family planning. We don't typically recommend that during the breastfeeding period, mostly because the menses are so irregular. And then finally, you've already mentioned the levonorgestrel-releasing IUDs, which is the Mirena IUD or the Skyla. There's also the copper T. The copper T has no hormones. And so for people who are sensitive to hormones, that may be a good option as well. Definitely talk to your provider about them and see kind of what the pros and the cons are for all of them in your particular case, I'd say.
Okay, perfect. Thank you very much.
Thank
I appreciate
you.
It.
Right, bye. All right, we'll go to Robert. Zach, pay attention. We'll go to Robert right now in Adams. Yes, Robert?
Hello. I have a question in two parts. One is, what is the best natural lubricant for sex? And then two, what is the best thing probably to add a little tingle during oral sex with her?
Well, I'm not sure what that means, but...
Right. So for natural lubricants, it depends very much on your circumstance. So it depends whether you're attempting pregnancy, in which case many folks will try to use nothing at all, or water. Some women do use things like olive oil or coconut oil or mineral oil, but obviously you don't want to be using these if you're using a latex condom. As for your second question, you know, there is so much material and data out there easily available to the lay public. I would direct you probably to start with Google.
Thank you, Robert. Okay, there we go. And now, let's see, we have a couple more people on the line. Let's go to Sue in Pittsfield. Sue in Pittsfield, you're on. Go ahead.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. My question is about my daughter who... will be 13 this spring. She started menstruating when she was 11 and a half, and she was very upset about it, feeling completely unprepared emotionally, as one might expect. But it seems to me that her PMS symptoms have gotten worse and worse as time's gone on. And in fact, after doing quite a bit of research, I pretty much figured that she has PMDD. Went to talk to her primary together. We all went, and my daughter and I spoke to the primary physician, and she actually recommended Prozac, a 10 milligram dose, in the 2 weeks prior to her menstruating. She's fairly regular. My daughter refuses to take it. She thinks something's wrong with her. She has to take a pill, even though I called it Seraphim instead of Prozac. Not that she knew it, would know what Prozac is, but she could totally look it up anytime she wanted to. So what I'm trying to do now is cook more foods and give her more foods with tryptophan in them. I don't know if that's going to work yet because we're waiting to see what happens. But what are your thoughts about all this?
Good question, Lisa. PMDD is a big problem with a lot of patients. It's where you would have the premenstrual symptoms along with signs of depression. And one of the treatment methods is being on antidepressants. And I think that if your daughter does not feel comfortable being on these antidepressants, trying these natural forms can help.
What else besides the do you agree that tryptophan is something that might help?
I agree that it can help.
And any other suggestions?
So there's a very broad range
of something I might be missing.
Oh, there's a broad range of treatments. You know, there are actually apps that you can help to track your symptoms and help some self-awareness, and sometimes that can work really well with this generation as well.
What is the good idea, doctors? What is the natural age that most women start to menstruate?
12 years old is the average age of menstruation, but it's becoming, you know, most patients are, it's getting younger and younger.
It's also really variable, so we've had patients as young as 6 and a half start with their periods.
Really?
Oh, gosh.
And as late as 16 or 17.
Wow, isn't that interesting?
And I bet conversations about early menstruation haven't caught up yet with those young people. I mean, I don't know how much support there is for people who are that young. Women that are young women, girls. Yeah.
Okay.
Okay, well, thank you.
And thank you. We are just about out of time. My apologies to Katie and Lisa, who are left on the line. I want to thank Drs. Thamaj Small and Anika Chady of Southwestern Vermont Medical Center for being with us today. Support for Medical Monday comes from Albany Cardiothoracic Surgeons, providing patient-centered heart surgery for over 40 years in the Capital Region, practicing cardiac surgery at St. Peter's Hospital, ACTURG.com. Again, ACTSURG.com. Thanks to our engineer, Zach Malloy. Thanks to Louise Butler for answering the phones. Our producers, Jim Lavoulis. I'm Alan Chartok. Thanks again for joining us on the Vox Pop. Remember, everybody, we can't have programs like this if we can't get that lockbox filled up. And that's at WAMC.org. The conversation continues on Vox Pop online at WAMC.org/Vox Pop. Stay tuned now for a news update.